Okay. All right, take your Bibles and turn to Ecclesiastes with me, and we'll continue our study in this. We are still in the first chapter, and we'll finish the first chapter in 3 weeks. That is a record, pretty much, right there. So, remind you as you're turning this, just to bring everybody kind of up to date a little bit. The message here is from Solomon. The Bible makes that very clear that Solomon is the author of this, and. Here's the one who's considered the wisest man in the Bible in the world, and most scholars believe that Solomon wrote this at the end of his life. He'd already lived his life. And you'll see it in the writing. He's pretty much done everything, and he comes to the conclusion that everything without God is vanity, and that's the theme. And the only one that can fulfill the life or fill the life of a human being is God himself. Yet man runs to and fro seeking everything else, and he uses this phrase over under the sun, seeking everything else under the sun to satisfy our deepest need, only to find out that it leaves us empty. And again, that's not a condemnation, and he doesn't actually do that. He doesn't condemn things here. He doesn't condemn experiences. He doesn't condemn owning certain things. He doesn't condemn having money. He doesn't condemn all of those things. But once again, what he does is he puts them in their proper place. They cannot fulfill your life. They cannot give you what you need. There's something more valuable than anything this world can give you. That's the message of Ecclesiastes. Now he's going to work through that with us. And last week we began looking at his short dissertation, if you will, on wisdom and the vanity of wisdom, which is kind of an interesting thing. You think if anybody would think that wisdom was the answer, who would it be? Certainly it would be Solomon. And yet here's a man, again, the wisest man to ever live, which did not, I always like this thought, which didn't always make the wisest choices. You know, he had the wisdom, but he didn't always make the wisest choices. You know, he found out that some of his choices were not very good, not only for himself, but for his kingdom. Because remember, after his kingdom, what happened? After his reign, what happened? The kingdom split. Had a divide of the kingdom in those who followed him. So, in verse 12 through 15 last week, we began looking at his statement that even striving for wisdom is vanity. Because why? Is wisdom bad? Of course it's not bad. Do we need wisdom? Well, the Bible says if you lack wisdom, ask and God will give you wisdom, and he'll pour it in you liberally without finding fault. So wisdom must be a good thing. But the point, once again, is wisdom is not the thing. Wisdom is not the thing. Remember that. Okay, so look at verse 16. We'll start there. He said, I communed with my heart, saying, look, I have attained greatness and have gained more wisdom than all who were before me in Jerusalem. My heart has understood great wisdom and knowledge. It's almost sound like he's bragging here. This is not a brag. How many? We'll go by age here. How many ever remember the old Western, the Sons of Will sonnet? Anybody besides me?
I remember the name.
Well, oh, come on. Walter Brennan.
What did he say?
Walter Brennan was the patriarch, and he had two sons, and his son was a gunfighter, and one of his other sons was trying to always find the gunfighter son. Everybody said, well, your son was the fastest gun in the West. He goes, second to me. And then he would always say, no brag, just fact. Okay, so with that in mind, because none of you remember that.
It was only on Chandler PBS.
Yeah, that's probably true. They filmed it outside of the city limits. So, anyways. It's going to be a rough night. I can tell that already. When your examples don't work, what do you do? Anyways, this is not from a boastful place that he's saying this. Actually, it is a place of self-evaluation. And you could even look at it this way if you wanted to. You could probably look at your own life and see all the gifts that God has poured into your life. And you can talk about those things. Well, his gift certainly was wisdom, and God gave him great knowledge and stuff, and he acknowledged that and stuff. But even in saying that he was the wisest man that Jerusalem had ever known, once again, he's trying to say that did not meet his need. So we look on verse 17, and he said, I set my heart to know wisdom and know madness and folly. I perceive that this also is grasping for the wind. Okay? Folly, another word for folly, foolishness. Okay? So I grasp for wisdom, which he said last week, is like grabbing for the wind. You know, you can feel it. You know it's there. You see even the results of it. But if you ever try to grab it, it leaves your hand empty. You can't grab it. It's an impossibility. And yet, once again, he says this, even with these great things that men think, you know, how many times you heard or maybe thought yourself, if I just had, or if I just were, if I was just that person, if I just had their talent, if I just had their resources, if I just, and we approach life so often that way, if I just, and we neglect to see that because you are a child of God, and again, we don't want to move into cliche, but we have to remember that because you're a child of God and Jesus Christ lives in you and the Holy Spirit indwells you, you have everything. You have everything that you need. Matter of fact, I would say you have more than you need. It's just a matter of how you look at things. And I think a lot of what we've done is we let the world condition our thinking. We let the world tell us what will give us fulfillment in life rather than seek what the Bible has to say about that. So, but look at it. He acknowledges. He said, I sought after wisdom. I sought after foolishness. You know, I think some people get this idea that Solomon, all he did was sit around just thinking wise things. You know, but clearly that's not him. He, you know, there had time he had to let his brain rest. So he just did what was foolish at the same time. He even used the term, you know, folly, and he used the term madness. Just, you know, just doing craziness. He said, I perceived that all this was grasping for the wind. So whether it is wisdom, great wisdom, foolishness, or craziness, not a one of them can meet the need. Not a one of them are bad in and of themselves. Everybody's got to let off steam, and everybody's got to just have fun sometimes. You know, you don't want to be that person that's always so serious that nobody even wants to ever be around you, right? You probably know people like that. You know, their gift is to be a downer wherever they are. So it's just not fun to be around those kind of people. And there's a time, you know, and he's going to talk about that a little bit later. There's a time for this time. There's a time for great seriousness. There's also a time for great joy. And there's a time to be quiet. And there's a time to shout. And, you know, there's all these kind of different times that we've been given. And they are, to me, they are what make up part of the fullness of life. And I don't want to jump ahead, but that's part of, you know, and when we get to that, we'll all sing the bird song. Now, how many of you know the birds? Okay, there you go. Kathy will lead us in that when we get there. So, all right. Look at verse 18, though, which is an interesting thing. He says, for in much wisdom is grief, and he who increases knowledge increases sorrows. Have you ever felt like that? I wish I didn't even know. I deal with this all the time. Not that I'm gaining a whole lot of knowledge. I guess I am. I'm still learning this stuff, of course. But when someone says something that I didn't know before and then they say it, I mean, it leads either to disappointment or disgust or sometimes even anger. How can anybody do something like that or say anything like that? It just, you know, and which a lot of people don't read. I know I have friends, they don't read papers anymore. They don't look at the news anymore. They don't do those things because, so I had that experience today in the office, and Linda's sitting in for Donna, and so she saw my head explode today. You know, there's smoke coming out and everything like that. I read the paper. Here's what I read in the paper. Why do so many Christians still hang on to the outdated myths like the virgin birth?
Oh, my goodness.
You say, well, certainly some atheist must have said that. But actually, it was a pastor of our local Fountain Hills Methodist Church.
Oh, my God.
Now, think about what he just said. Why do so many Christians hang on to outdated myths like the virgin birth? This is the man who's already stated he doesn't believe in the resurrection of Jesus Christ, doesn't believe in the vicarious death of Jesus Christ upon the cross. He's made all of these kind of statements. Okay? And he has a congregation of people who are listening to him think that, you know, he thinks he's smarter than the Bible. And bless you. So that's information that I, you know, about 10 minutes after I read it, I wish I wouldn't have read. But it tells you where people are, you know. And Solomon talks about this even in his own journey. Certainly had much wisdom, but you know, think about it. If you're the wisest man in the world, well, we see this even in Solomon's life. You always have people coming. Always have people trying to get a part of you, you know. You know, everybody's dispute needs to be settled by the great Solomon. All these different kingdoms have to come and meet this great wise king of Israel. You see that in the scripture how these things took place. And again, with knowledge comes, he says, with knowledge comes sorrow. You have to deal with the reality of what is. And sometimes the reality of what is and what is true is not a very pleasant thing to deal with. So, again, he's saying he's not putting these things down. He's just putting them in a proper perspective and saying, you know what? It's not always a great blessing to be the wisest man on the face of the earth. It's not even a great blessing to have, quote, all the knowledge that man might have. We would think that it would be, but it's not. Some of the smartest men that we have today are very tormented men. You know, I think about, what's his name, in England, Hawking. You know, the guy?
Stephen.
Okay. So when you don't get to hear him very much, but when you read what his writings are, stuff, he's a tormented individual. I mean, he's a great physicist, I guess, but he's just a very tormented man.
Do you think it's because when you have the knowledge of great good, you also have the knowledge of great evil?
I don't think it can be avoided. I think you're exactly right. The more you know about what is true, I think that the opposite has to correlate. You'll know the enormity of great evil. What our generation has a tendency to do with most things that are unpleasant to us is that we, and just understand why I'm saying it, we want to drug ourselves up so we don't have to deal with it. So we either drink ourselves silly so we don't have to feel anything, or we take drugs to do that, and sometimes we go to doctors who will say, well, you know, I'm feeling kind of blue, and you know, so okay, you're feeling kind of blue, so what do you need? Well, thank you for that diagnosis, doc. You didn't help me out any. Now, that's not to say that people do not have emotional things where they might need medication. Don't get me wrong. I'm talking about the we don't want to feel anything, so we block. And I think that's true. When we block the bad, guess what else we block? The good. When we're open to the good, then I think we're also open to the bad. And there, that's kind of heavy.
You know, one of the things that these prison men find is that the more they know, the more they realize they don't know.
Yeah.
So they have an endless search for the answers that they can't get. And they may be smart enough to solve certain things, but then there's always one thing they cannot figure out. So there's an endless search for knowledge, and they're just never...
And there's not an end to it. Yeah.
Well,
he's going to talk about that, too.
At the end of this book, but they don't want to see that.
Right.
You know? So.
Yeah. Okay. So he struggles with this matter, and what, again... These things which are not bad in and of themselves, if you're finding the answer for why you exist and what life's all about, you'll not find them in wisdom, you'll not find them in knowledge. That's what he's telling you. Yet again, there are many people who believe just the opposite of that. Do they not? All right, now we move on to the next area that Solomon deals with here. In chapter 2, he deals with the vanity of striving after pleasure. Okay, well, if academics and thinking and knowing and all this stuff did not bring me happiness, well, what about just throwing caution to the wind and doing whatever I want to do? Just enjoying life to the place where I just fulfill my pleasures and I satisfy myself that way. Certainly that kind of lifestyle would bring me contentment. Yet we all know that there's a huge lie in that too. It cannot bring. And he deals with that. By the way, Solomon, I think you'll find here in his life, he didn't, when I read this, it's like he didn't keep his hand from anything. If he wanted it, he did it. He tried everything. Okay? So we read, he said, I said in my heart. So basically when it says I said in my heart, I said to myself. Okay? Come now, I will test your mirth. Therefore, enjoy pleasure, but surely this was also vanity. So, And most translators talk to this about the sexual pleasure. Okay, this kind of pleasure that he refers to right here, and he said, "Well, if I indulge in this, certainly this will fulfill my needs, and I won't have any wants." And yet, what does he say? That too left him empty. And you're talking about a man who had 300 wives and 700 concubines. And think about that. That really isn't. You wonder how he ever had time to think, right? So, you know, but it's just nuts, you know. So, there's a reason why the Bible does not teach polygamy is okay, much less whatever 1,000 times that is. But you know, he did. He indulged himself, and he doesn't lie about it. He talks about that. He indulges himself in these things, thinking that, you know what, if this lady does not satisfy, there's certainly going to be someone more beautiful, someone more satisfying. And you know, and there's not too many guys walking around with 1,000 women today, but we know men. What, remember Wilt Chamberlain? We don't know how many, you know, he was with. He talked about tens of thousands in his lifetime. You know, I got here at the right time.
I came in at the
wrong time. Walk in the wrong time. But you know what? Wilt Chamberlain died lonely. It's a very sad thing. Magic Johnson's the same way. And he wakes up one day and has to stand before the world and say, "You know what? I have the AIDS virus." It's just these things will not satisfy. And yet, man does not learn.
Yeah, and since we're on the song theme tonight, remember the song, "Is That All There Is?" Is that all
yeah,
there is?
Yeah, I remember
is
that.
Is that all there is? Mm-hmm. And I can't remember what the...
Who sang that?
Peggy Lee.
Peggy Lee? No, I don't remember that.
I forget who. Anyway, some woman.
Okay.
It was Peggy Lee.
Atula Clark.
It was Peggy Lee? Okay.
Okay, we'll look it up. Is it on YouTube?
I have no idea.
Okay. It's a song. Is that all there is?
What is it on YouTube?
Oh, yeah, that's true. All right. Verse 2 now. He goes, "I said of laughter, it is madness, and of mirth, what does it accomplish?" In other words, you know, when you sit down and you evaluate and it's all over, it's all said and done, your pleasure's done, the momentary excitement or joy is done and stuff, you sit there and you're just sitting there. I think there's a song by Peggy Lee like that. So that's how it leaves you empty. It leaves you wanting. This is so good, this book, because it reminds, things cannot satisfy. And we believe the lie that they can. And once we get those things, then we've all learned this at different levels, you know. Got to have that latest thing for Christmas, right? Got to have that latest toy. Your kids are that way. You remember when Cabbage Patch Dolls were when our kids were little and stuff? And parents fighting each other and throwing each other around for the last Cabbage Patch Doll. And guys paying thousands of dollars for the... You remember when Twinkies said they weren't going to make any Twinkies anymore?
Yeah.
And they were selling boxes of Twinkies for several $100.
It's not even real food.
Yeah. Nobody knows what it is. But, you know, it's funny. They have to have it. I've got to have that box of Twinkies. I've got to have that Cabbage Patch doll. And then when you get it, and you maybe the latest toy, Tickle Me Elmo or whatever this is and stuff like that, you get it for your child, and then they look at it and go, "Oh," and set it aside. And you what's wrong with you, kid? It took me this much money, this much effort, and all this stuff, you know. And they'd rather play with the empty box.
That's true.
So it's an amazing world we live in. But we're not much different than kids. We do the same thing. We get toys and stuff, and they shiny for a while, and then they lose their luster. They can't fulfill anything for very long. Again, it's not a condemnation of those things, because those things are okay kept in their proper perspective. But if you expect them to fulfill who you are, they will not. Okay? Verse 3. "I searched in my heart how to gratify my flesh with..." Now it goes on, "with wine, while guiding my heart with wisdom, and how to lay hold on folly, till I might see what was good for the sons of men to do under the heaven all the days of their life." So what's he saying? Well, he's saying a whole lot there. He said, "I tried it all at one time even. And I wondered if everything, basically, he's giving a picture, if everything that man says is, will bring you happiness and fulfillment and stuff like that, suppose you did it all at one time. Suppose you completely indulged in it all at one time. Surely, if one won't bring you happiness, if you indulge in all of it one time, surely that would bring you fulfillment. And the result is, once again, the result is that it does not. So, pleasure of the flesh, wine, folly, just good times, they will not, Solomon again declares to us, they will not bring you fulfillment. Verse 4 in chapter 2, he moves on to another area. Well, if again, he's building a case here. Like, remember, like I told you last week, he's called the preacher in this book. Ecclesiastes, the word means assembly. He's building a sermon type here. He begins by making a statement. Now he's giving you examples. Gave you the first example. Wisdom doesn't do it. Pleasure doesn't do it. Now the next example he's going to give. Accomplishments. If I just achieve great things, somehow my achievements in life will bring me satisfaction and give me a fulfilled life. And boy, is this not an area that the Western mindset would really buy into, I think, a lot. You know, why do I exist? I exist to get ahead. I exist to achieve. I exist to leave a legacy where I can have a good grave marker where everybody can know how special I was while I was here. That's the Western approach, guys. That it really is a Western philosophy. I've got to achieve something. I got to do something special. My name has to be in the history books. I got to have a reason for my existence, and the world needs to know that I was here. Okay, I really like the thought that I've heard said before by teachers and pastors. Well, you know, if you listen, or if I share with you, and you forget my name, you forget who I am, you forget I ever was here, but you remember Jesus. That's the most important thing. I think that's the way we're called to live our lives. When we leave this place, hopefully more people will remember Jesus because we were here than remember that we were here. Think about life that way. Dixie.
Plus, I've heard that to be remembered is to pass it down through your children in generations. That's one way to be remembered.
Think about it this way. Just use the word heritage. What is the heritage that you want to leave your children? What do you want your your kids and your grandkids and your great-grandkids, some of who will never meet you, what do you want to leave them? You know, and so, you know, you could leave them things, but things are used up and things are lost and things are all, but what do you want to leave them? And that's a huge question, you know.
Family religion.
Huh?
Only religion, spiritual, pass it down.
Yeah. All right, so he begins this part with verse 4 where he says, I made my works great. I built myself houses and planted myself vineyards. And Solomon was a part of the great building boom of Jerusalem. You have the temple, a magnificent building. You had also much of the buildings of Jerusalem, including the building up of Mount Zion, which is a place where the king's palace was, along with the walls, along with the temple. It was just, you know, there had never been a time of building like that before, certainly. And the next time they would have anything close to that, and actually an expansion, would be when a guy by the name of Herod shows up. And Herod would expand Jerusalem, and Herod would rebuild the temple, which is the temple that was there when Jesus was there, which was a magnificent building, the temple was, when Jesus was there. Jerusalem became one of those jewels of the Middle East when Solomon was king. Everybody wanted to come and see what he did and what he built and the extravagance. I mean, there was nothing spared. It was really a monument to himself, you know, his achievement. So he talks about that, and he talks about vineyards. If you go over to Israel, we went on a trip to Israel. His influence goes far beyond Jerusalem itself. On a place called Megiddo, Armageddon, we go there, when we go there, when we go to Israel. And that's where he actually had all of his, he had all of his stables. I mean, just thousands of horses and chariots. It's an incredible place, where he had all of those things and stuff. He was, just what he did was just, you know, crazy in the time that he lived. So just to come see Solomon and his achievements was a special trip for people. So he goes on to talk about, you know, the vineyards and the produce and stuff that he did. And verse 5 he says, I made myself gardens and orchards, and I planted all kinds of fruit trees in them. I made myself water pools from which to water the growing trees of the grove. And you know, he had an ancient irrigation system where, because if you go, those of you have been, how many of you have been over to Israel and stuff, okay, so you know that it, naturally water, it's still like a desert region, okay. Israel today does some fascinating things. I mean, they're pulling water out of the Mediterranean Sea, taking the salt out of it, and they're turning the place back into this big green belt. And they're teaching Jordan how to do this too. You can see it as it crosses the Jordan River. That green thing goes right into Jordan. And, you know, and our guides, the guides are funny. Say, well, in Israel, we invented irrigation. In Israel, we invented the cherry tomato, and we invented bananas. That's too much. So but there are, you can't believe it. There are banana groves. There are avocado groves. There are orchards over there. It is incredible. And for a long period of time, there was a big area of it that was like a marsh, or what's the other word that we use down there from Louisiana? The
swamp.
Yeah. And what they did is they came in and they came with those eucalyptus trees. They planted them all. They sucked that water out of the ground. What was left was rich ground and stuff, and they were growing stuff. It's an incredible place now. I mean, they're feeding. We talked about this. Israel is the only first world nation surrounded by a group of third world nations. And they're feeding their enemies. Okay? You don't get any of that on the news, I know. But that is the reality of a lot of that and stuff. So it was that way in Solomon's day, too. It was a beautiful, lush place as his great wisdom and his great knowledge was able to turn the desert into something that blossomed. We have a little bit of feeling of that because we're, you know, if you've been in Arizona, some of you like me, I've been in Arizona for 56 years now. So, you know, I remember growing up in Chandler, I remember when Chandler was all agriculture. Guys I grew up with in school and stuff were a bunch of farm kids, poor as they could be, working the farm. Now they sold all their land to all these businesses and stuff. These guys got millions and stuff. Do they remember me? No, not a bit. So, but, you know, it's all changed. But we understand how water can do something, even in a desert. You know, we were crossing the Sinai Peninsula and stuff, and our guide says, well, he was talking about the desert. He says, well, you're used to this desert because you're from Arizona. I said, no, our desert's pretty. It doesn't look like this. But, you know, it's a little, there, that's a little bit more arid than it is here. But, all right, so he talks about this. Verse 6, you know, I made myself water pools from which to water irrigate the trees. Verse 7, I acquired male and female servants and had servants born in my house. Yes, I had greater possessions of herds and flocks than all those who were in Jerusalem before me. Solomon, still known as probably the richest king that Israel ever had. Okay, and when it comes to servants, when it came to possessions, far and away, more than anybody. He had more than his father David, and he certainly had more than anybody that succeeded him in that position. Verse 8, I also gathered for myself silver and gold and the special treasures of kings and of the provinces. I acquired male and female singers, the delights of the sons of men, and the musical instruments of all kinds. It must have been quite a place to be there. Whatever he wanted. That's basically what he's talking about. Verse 9, so I became great and excelled more than all who were before me in Jerusalem. Also my wisdom remained in me. So, he's making a statement here that I just said. Richer than anybody. And richer than anybody that was to come after him, too. But he said that my wisdom remained in me. So, you almost think that if you didn't use your wisdom, somehow you'd begin to lose it. But that was not the case. God gave him that gift of wisdom, and God did not remove that gift of wisdom from him. That doesn't mean he always properly used it. Because look at what he next says about himself. He says, whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep them from them. Okay, I did not keep from them. And that's a statement. That's his plan. If his eyes, if he wanted it, he got it. I did. Go ahead.
This guy is a pretty lonely person.
I think so. Don't you?
I mean, the word "I" is used 14 times in 9 verses.
Oh wow!
Think about it. Self-promoted. I mean, everything is I.
Think, and have we not all met people like that? They seem like they have. They're successful. I know people that they seem successful. They seem like they got pretty much the world by the tail. But at the same time, can be the most insecure people.
Miserable.
Yeah, and they're lonely. They're insecure, and they have to keep promoting themselves. So almost to say, don't you see how special I am? You should really like me, type thing. And that's really a sad way to live your life. And I'm glad you saw that, Rick, because I think you're right. I think you're right on about that. Here's a guy who had everything, but clearly as lonely as he could be. I mean, just think about in the relationship we talked about with his hundreds of wives. Why would a man want hundreds of wives? I mean, just think from that level. Why would he want hundreds of wives? I'm not down on women here, okay? So
because the first one is so good.
Oh yeah, you want to multiply that one, okay? Oh, that's a good answer. Oh yeah. Okay, we don't put up with that kind of stuff in here. So, but think, he had to be lonely in the midst of all of it. And if this is his final dissertation, which it really is, he lived a long, lonely life. Trying everything, and notice what he said. Whatever my eyes saw, I gave whatever I wanted. Goes on to say, middle of verse 10, I did not withhold my heart from any pleasure, for my heart rejoiced in all my labor, and this was my reward for all my labor. So he's basically saying, I deserve it. I deserve it. Huh?
It's tough being king.
I'm sitting here thinking, I wonder how much labor. I mean, maybe it's just my mindset. I'm just wondering how much labor that Solomon did.
Well, yeah. What was that? Thinking?
Yeah. Well, for some people, that's hard work. So.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, I, you know.
No, he. No way. Now, he did a lot of designing and planning and creativity stuff. You know, right.
He's an administrator.
Talk to any man who's an engineer. Yes, he works. He may not have been out digging the ditches or building bridges himself, but yes, that's work.
You think he did? You think he didn't get the wisest people around him to do that stuff? And then took credit. And then took credit for it.
No, I just think that I think that he took joy in his labor too.
Yeah.
And he considered something's labor.
The fruit of the labor.
Yeah.
Okay.
But he also wanted everybody to know.
Yeah, true. Because there's no satisfaction in just accomplishing something without recognition.
You know, we're only in chapter two. Yeah. But is there any place in here that he's going to talk about, like, me and the guys got together and we talked about all this? You know,
you don't see that.
No circle of friends around him.
Because there's nobody else as wise as him to talk to.
Yeah.
You know, think about it.
Well, that's a good point.
Yeah, but that many wives, though, I don't know if you have time for guys.
The lack in his life. You know, he just...
All right, we're going to move on from there. Thank you, Kelly. All right, verse 11. It said, then I looked on all the works that my hands had done. And I include this, and I know what you're saying, Mary, but I include this as anything that was done in his palace, anything that was done by his advisors, anything that was done by his builders, all this stuff, they were his. If someone else drew something, it was his. He was king. Like you said, it's good to be king. Okay? So he says, I looked at all the works my hands had done, and on the labor in which I had toiled, and indeed, all was vanity and grasping for the wind. There was no profit under the sun. Once again, understanding the definition of vanity, is that he's saying, these did not fulfill me. Thought they would. I thought if I accomplished great things and built a city that no one's ever seen before, had vineyards like no one's ever experienced, you know, horses, chariots, All these things, I thought if I did all these things that nobody has ever done before in human history, certainly my life would be full. And once again he says, it's like grasping at the wind. I reach out to grasp it and enjoy it, and when I pull back my hand, there's nothing there.
In my experience, part of the deception is it does fulfill you for a while.
Yeah, I think that's part of the lie.
That's what part of the deception.
Yeah, and again, I think understanding this, it's how we look at these things. If we look at the wonderful things God has poured into our lives and say, you know what, God has blessed me with these things, but these blessings are not why I exist. I exist for God. And so if God chooses to bless me with certain things, and we talked about this before, he didn't bless me so I can sit around and say, look how blessed I am. He blesses us that we might be used of him to be a blessing to other people. And in fulfilling the call of God in our life, which is walking with God and seeing God work in our life, there's where we're going to see the fulfillment. And at the end of this book, that's basically what he says. He finally learned it wasn't just for Solomon to say, look at me. Life, the world exists for me. The world is my playground. I mean, you know, man has not changed at all. I mean, look at what comes across your TV on the things that are supposed to appeal to you and to me and to fulfill your life. Your life is not fulfilled unless you have everything that crosses that TV. There's a reason why they spend what? How many millions of dollars for 30 seconds in the Super Bowl? $4.5 million for 30 seconds for the Super Bowl. Is that not just ungodly when you start thinking about it? I mean, just take $4.5 million for 30 seconds. Sometimes we ought to just sit back and say, that is just, everything's wrong with that. Everything's wrong with that type of thing. And what's also wrong with that is that people sit there, eat it up, and believe the lie and try to follow it.
Well, I'd imagine, and when you tell people that TV has an influence, they'll say, "No, TV doesn't have an influence on society." You know.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Yeah. That's not even a statement that can be taken seriously if you think about it. So, all right. Verse 12. Now, then I turned myself. So he's looking some more. I turn myself to consider wisdom and madness and folly. It sounds like he's returning again to what he's gone to before, right? He's already spoken of these three things. So I worked real hard. I worked to accomplish. I built these monuments for myself and stuff. I find out that they didn't fulfill. So what do? I return once again to just having a good time. Why should I work so hard? Why should I accomplish things when at the end of it I find out that they don't fulfill anything to me? Might as well have fun. Might as well fulfill the desire of my flesh, because both lead to the same place. And you know what the truth is? If that's what you're seeking for, he's right. They both do lead to the same place. An emptiness. And a hollowness. And a loss of meaning of life. You know, one of the things that, and I'm sure we've all done that, we've all sat back and looked, because we're all sort of getting that age, we have a couple of younger people here, but we're all getting to the age where we say, you know what, what does my life mean? You know, have I made a real difference in people's lives? Have, you know, we ask these, you know, and then maybe on a deeper level we might ask the Lord, Lord, have I been obedient to you and fulfilled what you have for me? You know, all these kind of questions run through our minds and stuff, and especially as we think about our own mortality, we start thinking about, you know, what's our life mean, and has it really made a difference? And I always love it when God, in His grace and His mercy, shows us those things, which the world would look at and say, it's not that big a deal. That's the way the world is. It's not that big a deal. But you know, when God shows you your kids. Or maybe someone that God used you to lead to salvation and they're following the Lord and stuff like that. You get to see these things. And again, the world would say, what's that? That's nothing. But that in heaven's economy, those are huge things. And the grace of God shows you those things. Or we could very easily get to this place if we just sit down and thought hard enough. You know, it's worthless. It means nothing. Life, you know, he's already said that. You're born, you live, you die. Nobody remembers you. All right, so he's going to return to, he says, to the wisdom, the madness, and the folly, and says, for what can the man do who succeeds the king? Only what he has already done. And this is an interesting little phrase. He's talking about those who will succeed him now. And basically what he's saying is, I've done it all. I've experienced it all. And whoever follows me, whatever comes after me, no matter what they've done, they'll never do more than I've been able to do. Which is kind, if you think about it, it's a hugely sad statement. Because he's already said that I've done it all, yet I find myself sitting here having to state that all it is vanity. All it is emptiness. Yet the next guy who comes after him to be king will seek out the same things. And the next guy will seek out the same things. And the next guy will seek out the same things. That's why at times when I read this book, I'm thinking, I don't want to read this book. You know? Some people like it a whole lot, but there are those thoughts, and you know, all right. Verse 13, then I saw that wisdom excels folly as light excels darkness. Now, what's he saying here? What he's saying here is that not everything's equal. Is wisdom better than foolishness? Yeah. Of course. Okay. Is light better than darkness? Well, of course. Okay. But, once again, wisdom is not the end all. In this case, light is not the end all. Okay? But there are some good things that God gives us for the journey. Wisdom, light, knowledge, understanding. These are good things. Unfortunately, far too many, even Christians, stop with those things. I know a lot about the Bible. Well, if all you do is know about the Bible, you're missing a big part of what it means to be a Christian. Talk about this. I shared this with my Tuesday morning Bible study. I saw a guy on a DVD this week. I thought he did a tremendous job. And what he talked about was most evangelical Christians have a disease. And the disease is called verse-itis. Verse-itis. Okay? We know verses in the Bible, but we don't know the Bible. The Bible was written as a story, not as a compilation of a bunch of different separate verses that you're supposed to just grab out and take. So, he used this wonderful example. He said, I used this on my class on Tuesday, so you guys already know this, but he used an example I thought was very good. He said, I could say this class, tell me John 3:16. I could say this group, tell me John 3:16, and I'm sure we could all do it. You think? But, now I'm going to ask you this. Tell me John 3:17 and 18. Okay? Tell me those. And not only tell me that, tell me the context of John 3:16. Tell me what's going on. Tell me why Jesus made that statement. Tell me what's involved in that whole thing. And most evangelical Christians cannot tell you that. Now, there are some that can, okay? And his point was is that we're teaching people to know verses, but not to know the story. The Bible was intended to be received as a whole. And each verse was intended to be understood within the context of the whole. And the way we have our Bibles, and we do it for convenience sake, for finding things sake, we all understand that. But what we end up doing is being people who have our particular or our favorite verses, and that's what we gravitate toward. Instead of read the whole story. John chapter 3. What is it? What's going on there? Nicodemus has come to Jesus. And he's trying to understand what it means to be... What's this born again thing? What's it mean to have salvation or eternal life? What's all this stuff mean? And this guy talked about how the Jewish people had... how many of you ever sat in a Seder or been a part of a Seder? Okay. Remember what happens at a Seder? Where do they meet? Where does the Seder take place always?
Around the table.
What is the Seder? It's the word itself speaks of a story. The word seder means story. Okay? And so what happens around that table? The father begins to tell the story. He doesn't just quote verses here or there. He tells the story. The children around the table are able to, and part of the whole thing is they're able to ask questions to gain understanding of the story. Okay? And this guy made a, and I'm going to do a little bit more research. I thought he did a great job talking about how we've lost the sense of that table and that place where we talk about, where we share the story. And the other thing he said is, for the Jewish kid, it's not a story just about Moses and the Jews coming out of Israel. They, in the whole scenario of the Seder, they become a part of the story. It's not a story of history. It's their story. And so, whether you meet a Jew who is Orthodox, who is observant, who is Reformed, or you even meet a non-practicing Jew, they know their story. Whether they believe in God or not, they know their story. And a lot of evangelical Christians don't even know their story. They don't know why you believe. Someone told me if I believe this verse, I'll be saved. They have no concept. And when you ask them, why do you believe what you believe and how does this all work out? They can't tell you. And again, throw a few verses, but not deal with what the story is. So he talked a lot about around the table, how important it is. He said the most sacred piece of furniture in the house ought to be the table. You know? And he said, you know, even some television shows have learned this. He said the two most popular television shows today have learned it. One is a reality show called Duck Dynasty. At the end of Duck Dynasty, always the whole family is around the table and the patriarch is sitting there leading them in prayer. Right?
Right.
The other one is a show on Friday night. It's called Blue Bloods.
Yeah.
Every show, that Tom Selleck's in that one, every show, the whole family is sitting around the table and talking to each other.
Yeah. And they pray.
And they're tied. And we're talking about multi-generational. They're tied together. The last example he gave to this, it was an example of the Amish people. And what he said the retention rate of evangelical young people and children is abysmal. And he's right. It's lower than 30%. Some even put it in the teens. I'm talking about in a family church, like our family church, the retention rate of young people in the next generation is just very low. In the Amish community, the retention rate is over 90%. It's so incredibly high that they've even made a reality show to show the anomalies, which is Breaking Amish. Maybe you've seen that show or heard of that. So it's so infrequent that they made a show out of it. Okay? Because for the most part, the Amish families stay together. They are a community. They know their story. In every Amish home, there are three books, the guy said. First book is the Bible. And they sit at the table every night when they meet together, and the father reads the Bible. The second book is what would be equivalent, it's not the same name, but would be equivalent to the Fox's Book of Martyrs. And they talk about those who stood for the faith and remained in the faith and actually even died for the faith, okay? And then the third book is a hymn book. It has no notes in it or anything like that, but it takes the words from the Bible and puts it into music, and they sing that around the thing. It's an incredible thing. And you know, he hit on some of these things when he talked about again us knowing who we are and us being a part of something bigger. You know, the evangelical church has bought into the way of the world. We've got to do it bigger, fancier, more electronic, more stimulating. Yet what science has told us is this: all this electronic stuff that we do is not as stimulating as you think that it is. It is folly. It is vanity. They have done tests on kids who are on their little computers, playing their little computer games and stuff, and their brain activity is pretty close to nil. It takes nothing. You take those same kids, put them in a music class, put them in a reading class where they're reading books, put them in an art class, put them in some place where they have to think and stuff, and their brain activity is just incredible. mind-numb robots if we're not careful.
I think what happens is we're overstimulated, and that therefore we become desensitized.
Well, if you want to talk about overstimulation, it's a stimulation like caffeine. It hits you hard, hits you fast, and leaves you dead. Okay, you know. But
oh, wait a minute! Now you're better.
No, no, no. So, go ahead, Ron.
You talk about the importance of story, and I think we make a mistake sometime when we celebrate the Lord's Supper, thinking that it's simply a ritual.
Yeah.
Telling a story.
Yes.
And I think that's one of our opportunities to build community. We're sharing in a common life. We're not just distributing elements.
We're
doing something significant.
It is significant, and we got to remember that, which is why we attempt not to make it just an add-on to a church service. But it needs to be what we're doing that day if we're going to tell it. Go ahead, Rick, please.
You know, Kathy and I spent about 6 years working in Awanas with kids.
Mm-hmm.
Wonderful program, except I started to wonder the process of getting children to memorize a verse. The goal was memorize a verse, move on to the next verse, memorize, 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 without them really even knowing what the verse was about.
I think we've...
And it really got watered down.
I think we're paying, to be honest with you, I think we're paying the price... Not just our church, but the overall evangelical approach to that. I think let's just be honest, guys. Our kids don't have a sense of identity of who they are. They know truth. They know what we say is true, and many of them have received that truth. There's no doubt about that. But there's a reason why, boy, we're out of time. I'll just say this. There's a reason why there's a huge disconnect from what we know to be true and the way we live our lives in the evangelical church today. You understand what I'm saying? If we are a part of the story, like the Jewish kid that I was talking about, if we are part of the story, the whole story that's right here, we'd understand that this is what our lives ought to look like. This is not just facts we have to memorize that we can separate from the way we live our lives, the decisions we make, and our actions. And that's the big problem I'm seeing over and over again, you know, after, you know, you get a little bit smarter after 30-something years of ministry, and I look back and I say, you know, I've taught them what the Bible says, and I've taught them how to memorize, how to know these things and stuff like that. But the approach is not what I would consider to be the best, because we have so many Christians who live what I call disconnected lives. There's no evidence, or very little evidence, in the way we live our lives, the way we make decisions, the way we treat each other, the way we raise our kids, the way we decide what we watch on TV, what we buy, anything. There's very little relation in those decisions with what we know to be biblically true. That disconnect is the problem with the evangelical church today. And I really do believe, even what you're saying and what Ron has said, I think the approach has been wrong, and I'm going to ask God to help me with this approach, because I think we have to be very careful to keep the story. So you don't memorize a handful of words; you understand what it means. And it's not a story of history; it's a story that you are a part of. It's who we are. And that's something missing in a lot of even Christian life. They don't feel like, if you ask them, are you part of this story? Is this story about you, or is it about Jesus, Peter, Paul, and Mary? Okay. Okay. I know that's bad. I know. Okay. So. It works. It works. Okay. So. But think about that. Most of our kids, and maybe most of our adults, will say, you know what, I don't really feel like I'm a part of this. I mean, I read it and I study it, and it's something I memorize and stuff, but this isn't me, which I think is wrong. I think God intends for this to be us. Now, how are we going to, boy, this is a whole new way of approaching things. You know, I'm really thinking hard through these things. It's a whole new way of approaching things, and it may take, what's that word that people like, a whole new paradigm. But it's not really a new one. It's getting back to what it is. We've shifted to paradigms that are not of the biblical model. They're not of the biblical model. I mean, we do this with our kids. What do we do with our kids? I'm convicted of this a lot. We separate our kids from worship. We separate our kids from the family. And we make excuses like they can't understand, they can't know, they can't be a part of that. We do that, don't we? You know? And I've always said this, and I haven't always practiced, but I've always said, I think our kids, youth, even adults, live up to what you expect of them. Or they live down to what you expect of them. You tell them they can't, they won't. You expect them to do some things, they will. So there's a whole lot. I mean, maybe this is a good time for us to be looking for staff members and stuff, because the pastor is really struggling with some of these things myself, and God really convicted me of this because, I'll just honestly say this to you. If I look back on the three previous churches that I pastored, when I left those churches, for whatever reason, many of the people that were under my ministry left and went to other churches. They didn't continue on as a family of God. And I told Teresa this many times, there's something wrong with that. And I couldn't figure it out. I couldn't get in my, why would people just scatter? Why would they leave looking for someone else they liked? Why wasn't there a connection? Why wasn't there a family? Why wasn't there, you know, we're a part of one another? How could you so easily just go off to somewhere else? And doesn't this happen all the time? It happened in this town incredibly a lot. Someone doesn't like what's said over at Christ Church, they come over here. Someone don't like what's said over here, they go to Christ Church. You know, in the 9 years I've been here, I've seen that little thing going on and stuff like that. I think people want to, you know, it ought to really be a part where we're saying, you know what, where does God want me to invest? We need to see that we are part of this family. And I think the leadership needs to do a better job at that. So you pray that God will help me work through this and be patient, because, you know, I don't want to just jump into something or do something and say, oh, this is going to fix everything. It's going to take some wisdom. And it's going to take some patience and stuff. But I think it's important, because, you know, someone had said in one of their surveys, I don't tell everybody what survey, but someone said if something doesn't change in 10 or 15 years, our church will be gone because it's old. I don't agree with that, because I think there will always be some of us old people around. But it won't be old. And we've got to do better with the next generation. And whether the next generation is our kids that are coming in, or someone that's 60 years old that comes to faith in Jesus Christ tomorrow, we've got to do better with the next generation. We don't need to teach them just to regurgitate words and no facts, but to see themselves in the story. That's a relationship, I think. That's what God intends. God gives you insight, please come talk to me. I'd love to receive some help from some of you. Jesse, lead us in prayer. We're dismissed, please.
Father, we just want to thank you for this time.